Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Shindig, a podcast about archaeology brought to you by the Red River Archaeology Group. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Horn, and I'm here as ever with producer extraordinaire and my co-host extraordinaire, Luke Barry. Yeah.
Hi guys, how are things? Tom, how are we? How are we this week? Are we ready for an excellent interview?
We are, and it's with one of our colleagues, Dr. Enda O'Flaherty, and he's done all the great jobs in our organization, you know, consultant to your project, and this kind of work he's being consultant towards at the moment is on major projects, mega projects, as you would call them. And what we were really asking today was about greenways. We're asking about essentially ways through the landscape that your heritage and the culture of a particular area can be made to sort of work again. So it might be reviving an old railway line and making that an active travel walkway. But there's so much more to it. It's fascinating. If you love environment, if you love archaeology, if you love Ireland and Enda's brilliant guest, this is the podcast for you.
Yeah, it's a great one. I had the privilege of filming his paper that he presented on this to EAA last year, and it was incredible. I was particularly struck by his his description of turning things into places, not spaces, which he goes into in this interview as well. It's a really good one. I think you're going to enjoy it.
So Enda, thanks so much for giving up your time today. We know how busy you are, so we're just going to sort of jump straight into it. You gave a talk at the EAA's 2023 in Belfast, and that was about development and rejuvenation, facilitating the historic environment and rejuvenating historic land infrastructure at scale for a living landscape. Now, that's quite a lot, but I suppose the question I really want to ask is what sparked your interest in this topic, and what kind of sparked your interest in these sort of current major regenerations, redevelopments of historic linear infrastructures? You know, the example most people know will be former railway lines and canals that are kind of being reused. So what kind of got your interest there, if I may ask?
There's quite a few things, Tom, really. I suppose my background is in landscape archaeology. So coming from that perspective, you always have quite a high level view, I suppose, of development and how it interacts with the landscape. But then primarily, I think when I looked at the subject, it's the engagement of two kind of possibly conflicting policies with each other, policies pertaining to the green environment and those pertaining to conservation and preservation of heritage. Both need to be facilitated, but sometimes there might be a little bit of conflict between the two of them. So that kind of got me going, I guess, it got my attention. And then when I got into it further, examining the environments that these new infrastructure would be developed on, what was interesting about them is that they kind of come with intrinsic heritage value compared to maybe some other linear developments that we might work on, like maybe new road schemes or even overhead cables, even or underground cables and overhead lines, that you're quite often going through largely what we considered a green landscape or whatever. But with this kind of infrastructure, you're engaging with something that's already a historic environment, and it comes with a certain amount of intrinsic heritage value. And it's that kind of clashing of worlds, I think, that piqued my interest and kind of drew me into doing a paper for EAA this year.
And to tell us a little bit about the hollowing out of parts of rural Ireland, both in terms of the population displacement to urban centres and the closing of railways.
Yeah. So hollowing out is a very kind of strong term. It might even be a loaded term because it kind of implies an intent, even, you know. It has been hollowed out. Things that you mentioned there, so population displacement, movement from particularly in Ireland. Ireland had been, compared to the rest of Europe, much more kind of rural-based population, agriculture-based economy up up into the 20th century and even into the late kind of 20th century. Even in our own lifetimes, we've seen things change quite a bit. But we say after the program for development in the 1960s, you see this through, you see kind of an intensification of people moving from the rural landscape into the cities. This is reflected in many ways. One of the ways it's reflected is in the closure of rural railway lines, and you can also see it in the consolidation of schools even across the country, where you see small rural schoolhouses being closed and kind of consolidated into single larger schools that cover kind of larger hinterlands. This is a kind of reflection of the changing kind of ways that people are getting around the rural landscape as well. Cars are available. Cars are also kind of detrimental to the railways as well, because as cars become available for people in the rural landscape, the reliance on kind of rail transport is lessened just for their domestic kind of transport. And all this kind of contributes to, we see what used to be former kind of thriving market towns in the rural landscape begin to decline. You can see this up to the present day, unfortunately, that you see a lot of dereliction in small rural towns across Ireland, particularly in the western seaboard or along the the border region, on both sides of the border too. I mean, it's not just something that's happened in the Republic. It's happened on both sides of the border, where natural hinterlands are split from each other. That's something that happened earlier. But that's a very broad topic to bring up. We could talk about it. It could have its own podcast, because it's had implications for all sorts of parts of the architectural and archaeological landscape, really, especially architectural heritage in small kind of rural towns as well. Am I answering your question?
What we'll do then is kind of is focus it, because again, sort of listening to the talk you gave at the EAAs and just what I've seen just over the last 6 months to a year with the All Island Strategic Rail Review and the plans for the National Cycle Network, what is kind of being done then to try and, I say rectify again, that might be a loaded term, to sort of try and get maybe back more towards the 1906 situation with much easier to sort of travel around than the situation we've got today?
Rejuvenation is the word that I chose. So it's rejuvenation of infrastructure that was functioning in the first half of the 20th century, but kind of had fallen out of use. I think it's important to see one element of the talk was the idea of a mega project. Now, when people visualize mega projects, they probably think of, again, massive motorways or very large, maybe an airport development or something like that. And this is a mega project untypical of those, because we're not talking about a colossal piece of single infrastructure. We're talking about a colossal concept, a concept of creating a new network or reusing old networks of communication through the landscape. And I think for me that is mega to conceive over, I think it's over 3,000 kilometres of active travel and greenway infrastructure, which is huge, absolutely huge. And that is also working in tandem with the All Island railway strategy. And the idea of simultaneously rejuvenating the actual railways themselves. So you're looking at a huge shift in the way that people were moving throughout the landscape into the 21st and into the 22nd century. And even to conceive that you're thinking that forward into the future, that you're changing the way that people will move throughout the country and how the country will in turn develop. These are huge concepts and truly mega projects, if you want my opinion.
We can see kind of what the view is towards the future with these kind of projects. But what impact does it have on our historic environment, these kind of projects?
Because you're going to have to, as I said at the top of the podcast, these routes come with their own kind of intrinsic heritage value. So you're talking about railway infrastructure that would be recorded with, say, the National Inventory of Architectural Heritage, for example, or they may be protected structures. So you're going to have to facilitate the requirements to rejuvenate. You're going to have to facilitate the rejuvenation of the of these elements of the architectural landscape to make them useful again, but also to make them useful, but also to make sure that they are protected and still retain their heritage value. We're not, it's not like a roadway or something like that where it's going through new territory and you can just kind of cut and fill your way through the landscape. Yeah. You're going to have to accommodate this infrastructure and these buildings. But you also have to consider that they are traveling between parts of the country that would have industrial archaeology related with them. Tommy, you mentioned earlier canals, but you can think that these canals were traveling between what were industrial centres in the 19th and even 18th century in towns, small towns and the few cities that we had in Ireland at the time. So you're going to have to accommodate all that industrial archaeology that these routes will have to engage with also. So it's a big ask to weld these two policies together, the policies of preservation and conservation of architectural heritage with policies of improving our transport network for the future so that it is less impactful on the environment.
I just want to jump in there with, I had the privilege of filming your talk in EAA last year, and you mentioned the Hardy Bucks, who are, if for our outside of Ireland viewers, they're an Irish TV show. Do you want to talk about why you mentioned them in it? Because I found it very interesting.
You did. Very good. So I don't know if in post-production here, Luke, you might want to put up the image of the Hardy Bucks.
I will.
The reason I chose that, because there's a reoccurring motif in the Hardy Bucks where they do a piece to camera. What you think about the show itself is up to yourself. But there's a reoccurring motif where they do a piece to the camera and they're in a rural town in Mayo, probably Northwest Mayo, I think it is. And the location where this piece to camera occurs is up on a disused railway bridge that overlooks the town. And this reoccurring motif is very insightful, in my opinion, because the whole theme of the Hardy Bucks is these kind of collection of young men who are kind of stuck in a small rural town. Mm. They have dreams of maybe going to the big city, such as maybe Galway or even further. But they're stuck in this rural town, and this piece of camera that they do every time up in this abandoned railway bridge, it kind of summarizes the whole environment very, very well. The standing on the derelict bridge kind of representing what was once the connection that the small town had with the outside world. And now these four young men with their future somewhat limited, their horizon somewhat limited, probably because they're just stuck in this town, and the whole thing kind of works very well. It kind of glues very, very well together. I thought it was a very insightful kind of choice of location. Mm-hmm. I guess they probably did that on purpose. It's quite clever.
I thought it was a really cool way to kind of, for me anyway, to blended things together, to have someone like me who wouldn't necessarily know an awful lot about infrastructures or archaeology in general and stuff, to get that point across, to understand it really spoke to me.
But it's the real world impact of removing infrastructure and removing towns, the connections the towns have with the outside world. The real world impact is that it limits people's horizons, and it drains young people out of towns, and it drains young people out of the rural landscape. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's a good motif, I think, that reflects that quite well.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting. I used to work in County Durham, and the way I got into work from a small mining or ex-mining village was walking along the Dearness Valley Railway Path, which was one of these, you know, sort of rural railways that was cut in the 1960s. People know it's the Beeching Cuts, but it was reshaping of British railways, I think it's the technical report that it came under. And yeah, there are these disused bridges that you walk underneath and over, and it's now a cycle, an active travel path, if you will. And that's that's kind of what's been happening in my side of the sea, in the UK. These former rail lines are being reopened as active travel routes. So, you know, in the 60s in Glasgow, the canals and railways would have motorways put over them. Now they're kind of maintained for the community, and they've got blue plaques, and you know that you're on a Victorian railway line that's been repurposed. And it's happening in the borders. The borders railway is being reopened in through the borders of Scotland as well, essentially trying to get between sort of Edinburgh and Carlisle and the sort of the great sort of towns and villages that are in the southern part of Scotland. What is the equivalent then, the trends that are happening in Ireland? Are these active travel routes being opened in old railway lines, or as in Scotland, sometimes you've got a housing estate built on them and you have to sort of go around them? What's happening in Ireland at the moment?
That's a whole hornet's nest. that's difficult to get into. Quite a lot of the land that was part of former railway lines was kind of reclaimed by local farms at the time. That kind of limits perhaps the reuse of some of the railway lines, or forces you to create kind of new routes over sections that might have been reclaimed from the railway line. What you mentioned there about, I suppose if we start with active travel routes and greenways, when we talk about real world consequences, the creation of these greenways and active travel routes allows people to engage kind of more directly with the landscape, and kind of get a kind of more up close and personal with the landscape, for want of a better term. From my perspective, I think this has a number of positives, but the primary positive that it has is that it kind of encourages engagement, and engagement encourages people caring about the landscape. It encourages people to be aware of the landscape around them, both from historical and cultural landscape perspective, but also from an environmental perspective, and encourages people to that which they're familiar with, they're going to care about a lot more. So that's one of the real world consequences. What you've mentioned there, what was the name of the cut? The Beaches Cut, was that right?
The Beeching Cuts of the 60s, call it, but there were two reports, the reshaping of British railways and the development of major railway trunk routes. So it was a couple of reports, but the sort of government minister was a guy called Beeching, and they're known as the Beeching Cuts. And the sort of cultural feeling is this was a very bad thing. I mean, of course, they would argue at the time that like there were two people a year stopping off at a particular rural railway stop, and the rest of the system couldn't support it. So that was the kind of argument at the time.
Yeah. So as things are moving forward here at the moment, we've had some kind of interesting developments where former railway lines have been repurposed as greenways, and now with the All Ireland railway strategy, some of these greenways are being recommended to be reopened also, but people also want to retain the greenway. So what you're having is almost side by side, or kind of diverging from each other a little bit. Former railway lines that become greenways, and then they want to reopen the railway line also. So you're having both. Now there's kind of limited examples of that. I think Tuam, that's been proposed for the railway from what would be from Athenry north through Tuam and on up to, it might be Claremorris or Ballyhonis. Not too sure what the final destination is there, but they also want to keep the greenway there too, that is being developed. So people are kind of very enthusiastic to have both the greenway and the railway. And that's encouraging, I think, that people are kind of visualizing that there will be alternatives to the over-reliance probably on the car, particularly, let's say, outside of Dublin. So I guess we'll see how this kind of develops over the coming short few years, really, because this is a plan that will change the future and will change the coming 100 years, but it's not going to, you know, it's happening now. It's not pie in the sky this time.
You mentioned greenways there, and it's I guess a word that kind of came up more and more toward the general public over the last few years.
Are you going to ask me what's a greenway?
What is a greenway? Yeah.
You might want to cut this out, Tom. I don't know. I saw that question and I meant to actually look up a definition of it. So I can, yeah.
We can just pause it now. The look will make it seamless. It'll just be like we'll be back.
I meant to look up a proper definition of that because I saw the question. I don't know, Tom, if there's a proper definition. A greenway, a way by traveling through a green.
I think you can then define it. I think there can be a definition of what do you want a greenway to be and what do you think in terms of what commercial archaeology can do and what we can do to, you know, bring people past and through and by sort of our cultural heritage. Because I mean, I know, again, going back to Scotland, we've got there's one canal to Edinburgh that's now got the M8 motorway on it, but there's another canal that's now, I now link it in my mind, and I think we link it as in Greater Glasgow and Central Scotland to the Antonine Wall, the Roman Wall that people will talk about, the B-side of Roman walls, if you will, that because it passes all the forts there and eventually goes to the Falkirk Wheel, which is a great bit of engineering. It's a boat lift. But behind that is one of the most famous forts in the Antonine Wall. So that if you can walk that canal and walk the Antonine walks of Roman Scotland, essentially. So, you know, what would you define it and what do you want out of a greenway in terms of its relationship with cultural heritage and what we can do as commercial archaeologists?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So greenway is an off-road kind of route that is intended for non-motorized transport, really. Now, what a greenway can be, I suppose this kind of ties in quite well with what we do as archaeologists. Quite often when we're developing other linear infrastructure, we're often trying to avoid impacts with architectural and archaeological heritage. Greenways kind of also present an opportunity because they're a slower mode of transport. People are more kind of directly engaged with the landscape. You can almost steer people towards archaeology because they're less impactful as well. They have a narrower corridor compared to a motorway. People are traveling much slower. And as I mentioned in the last section, people are much more engaged with the landscape. So there's an opportunity to steer people towards archaeology and for them to stop and take the time to engage with the landscape and for us to, things that you would think of like installing information boards and giving people again time to engage with maybe minor monuments, you know, that would be along the route. Quite often people will be coming to Ireland and engaging with things like the Rock of Cashel, and they might go to Galway and they might go to Killarney and they might be back to Dublin again. They might go to Dublin Castle and they might take in Kilkenny. You know, Kilkenny is one of the big ones too. And they're back on an airplane and gone again. Whereas if you're traveling at a slower pace through the landscape and if you're steered slowly towards these kind of significant, probably less showstopper sites, whatever, people have the time to engage with them and they're less busy, you know. And they have the time to absorb the kind of significance of the sites and the landscape. So those are great opportunities, I think, that are available for archaeologists. And it's one of those things where policies don't have to clash, where the policy for preservation and conservation of architectural heritage doesn't have to clash with the policy for decarbonizing our method of getting around the place, really.
I mean, I just think before Luke jumps in with the next question that has made me think, because we were chatting to Keith Ness Broth Project the other day, and Kenneth from that also works on the John O'Groats path. And, you know, with the Keith Ness Broth Projects and the John O'Groats path, the Keith Ness Broth Projects is trying to sort of like look at the fact that there's the North Coast 500 going past it, and they want to rebuild a broch there that stops people and communities that they might just drive past. He's also working in the John O'Groats Trail, which is a walking trail as well. And again, it's talking about what you're talking about there, that sort of slower. So Keith Ness is a really great case study and interesting. You've made me think about that in terms of the podcast that we just recorded earlier this week, in terms of you've got the different paces, you've got the sort of
the heritage sites that you'll see maybe by car or by tourist coach, and then you've got the ones that you're now getting the second generation in Caithness already. You're getting the people going, okay, maybe people are just zooming past things and just going to certain sites, and now we maybe just want them to have that slower pace through the landscape. Yeah. So yeah, that's
you can have, both. You know, one like it's not that we're going to get to it's not that Dublin Castle isn't going to be a very visited site because greenways exist, but you have an option there for people who want to not be in a kind of crowded tour of large heritage sites, whatever. They have the option to meander through the landscape. Exactly what you're describing there at Caithness, that people can be directed to these kind of sites that are accessible. They were made accessible and easy to get to, but by the greenways and by the active travel routes, and that they will have the time to and the time to engage with them at their leisure, without any kind of commercial pressure, I suppose, and that they're getting off that very, very well beaten in Ireland in particular, a triangle that goes from Dublin to quite often to Killarney to Galway and back to Dublin again and to the airport and away people go, you know. So those are wonderful opportunities, and that ties in quite well what Luke brought up about the idea that the rural landscape has been hollowed out. I mean, you're bringing people, you're bringing tourists back to these kind of smaller towns as well, in the rural landscape, creating opportunities for people who live there, opportunities for young people who might want to stay in the local area. So all these are positive in my view.
Your talk was about mega projects and greenways and that. Does the greenway necessarily have to be a mega project? Or
no, of course not. Yeah, of course not. Yeah, it can be at any scale at all. They're quite local. greenways and walking paths, you know, that are only maybe, you know, even just a couple of 100 meters or something, that might connect to areas and they can be utilized by the local community, or maybe just a couple of kilometers. They come from all different kinds of sources. The ones that we're kind of referring to here are quite are being pushed by TII, you know, that they're kind of spearheading what's happening. But, you know, they do happen, and they have happened in the past locally, and they've been organized quite often locally, local people seeking funding from different sources. But I suppose when we're thinking of it as a mega project, we're thinking of it as a concept, the concept that there are alternatives to what has become the ubiquitous form of travel, particularly in rural Ireland, because there are no other options, or very few. There are limited options, and that's the car. And the car needs a road, and the road needs to make its way through the landscape. You can see that in many of our urban environments as well. If you compare images of maybe the turn of the 20th century there, Victorian and Georgian times, and the magnificent kind of splendor of cityscapes that are open and you know, they have to accommodate horse and carriage and maybe pedestrians, and you can compare that to what we've done to our city centers over the past 50 maybe 75 years to purely to accommodate the car, rarely considering the kind of aesthetic impact that it has, or the chaos that it has caused. You know, it's only being reversed in the last, you know, maybe 20 years. You know, we can see that with congestion charges, that people are, that authorities are trying to reverse that. But, you know, there's a lot of damage to be undone.
We did a podcast recently that, as of recording, hasn't been released yet with Rebecca Boyd. And she said that I can't remember who she was quoting, but she was saying that Irish people don't belong in towns. They belong in the country. And I suppose with greenways, is that something that's been brought back in with the culture, that within towns and outside of towns, there is this element of nature a little bit closer and bringing us to kind of the outside area rather than the main town?
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that question. It's a strange
It was the whole, the background is, again, it's a bit like you get with the Normanist and anti-Normanist in the development of Russia and Ukraine with the Scandinavians, the sort of Germanic people making you live in sort of cities, and the Vikings in Ireland setting up these first sort of towns and cities. And, you know, there was an idea, I think, until relatively recently in Ireland that an Irish person's natural place was in the country, as opposed to an urban setting.
I don't see why an Irish person would be any different to any other human in terms of their propensity to live in an urban or a rural setting.
I guess it's a romanticized version of
that. Yeah, it was a national mythos. I think that was the kind of discussion that we were having. It's like the feeling rather than the reality.
Was this a kind of Devalerian kind of comely maidens dancing at the crossroads? And that kind of romanticized kind of rural living. That's another podcast we can.
I hope we're taking notes here. As I look at
Have you seen that recent film with Emily Blunt and what's his name from up the country? This is going off topic completely, but Jamie Dornan, that was the fella. And they did a film set in modern Ireland, but very much through the lens of that romanticized country.
Heard about it. Yeah.
I couldn't stop watching it. It was fantastically bad, basically, is the only way I can put it. Fantastic.
It sounds like it.
That's the thing. I think you get that just before we sort of bring it back around. In Scotland, we're all Highlanders, except everybody lives outside the Highlands. You know, so it's one of those, it doesn't have to be anywhere near the truth. And it's like, but it's what, you know, it's marketing. But to bring back to sort of the Greenways and your talk and your interests, sort of, it's almost like whether you've got a particular case study in mind or just speculating sort of now, but how best do you think we can incorporate the historic environment, the thing that we all care about as archaeologists, into the projects that we've been talking about, Greenways and rejuvenation more sort of generally?
At design stage, basically, I think, really. And that is happening. We can see that the projects that we're working on at Rubicon from conception to delivery, those who are designing them and those who are planning them are entirely aware of the heritage landscape, the cultural landscape, and the heritage impact. quite often we're commissioned to undertake built heritage surveys of buildings and even the infrastructure itself along the greenways, and this can be accommodated into information boards. I think I mentioned that before, that can be placed along the greenway to inform people of kind of the intrinsic heritage value of the landscape that they're traveling on. That is one way.
So getting back after our movie review to sort of greenways and what we've been discussing up to this point, how best then can we incorporate the historic environment into greenways and these similar sort of linear rejuvenation projects, and maybe talk a bit about, I think there's a SWOT analysis which you can explain about in the way that we can fully incorporate the care and attention towards the historic environment when we're working on these sort of projects.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's not me that has kind of conceived these things. These are kind of just observations of mine. There are plenty of people out there working on the same stuff. But in terms of a SWOT analysis and strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, I think one of the main strengths is the environment that you're working in has an intrinsic heritage value, as we've mentioned several times before. So it comes kind of loaded with meaning already. It's not that you have to work very hard to get meaning out of the landscape. It's already there. It's intrinsic. But this is also one of the weaknesses, because you have to take care of that, and you have to, in your efforts to rejuvenate the infrastructure, you have to take due care of the infrastructure to facilitate it properly and to allowed to still function and then to still function as a greenway without kind of impacting in any kind of catastrophic way on its, I guess it's intrinsic heritage value, really. Opportunities. The main opportunity is that there's an existing network all across the country in places that are seldom visited these days, from Northwest Mayo to West Cork to all along the border region and through the middle of the country. The network is already exists. That is an incredible opportunity and something that we should entirely capitalize upon. And the main threat is just you're not taking advantage of it is one kind of threat, you know, that we don't capitalize on it to the best of our ability. But, you know, that's up to us.
In your talk last year, you said there was a phrase, I paraphrasing here, but was it places, not spaces? It's stuck in my head. One because I like rhymes, and two, yeah. it just kind of simplified it from my stupid brain, I think.
Yeah, the concept of space and place, they're two kind of, maybe, you know, you might immediately kind of think of them as the same thing, but a space is just more or less a physical space, and it becomes a place of meaning when it's associated with an activity or when it has meaning. So you want to move from that idea of creating or just engaging with the landscape in kind of purely a functional kind of way and space, and just kind of manipulating space to deliver like a functional kind of piece of infrastructure, to creating a place with meaning. And that, you know, it can be done by engaging with the place's past meaning and past kind of use, I guess, and making sure that that's to the fore, so that you're creating places that people can be engaged with and people can understand. And again, kind of coming for a full circle, that encourages people to look after place and environment, and encourages engagement and kind of better stewardship, I think, of the landscape and the environment.
Yeah, I like that. It's a good, as a concept, I think it makes sense. It's something that you see a lot of like derelict buildings and stuff, and the word spaces is used so much. How can you use this space? How can you use this space?
Yeah.
I like the idea of making it a place. I know it's word differentiation, but like it's important.
Yeah, but it's important for people to kind of conceive that dereliction creates just spaces. Spaces are, you know, no good to anybody. You need to kind of move from, you need to allow people to engage with, you know, the landscape and the streetscape and everything, so that they have meaning and attachment to these places, and that meaning and attachment encourages people to care for them. And it's just a kind of probably a healthier outlook, I suppose, for people to have when they're engaged with their environment.
And now I'm going to be a bit dangerous here. I'm going to go off the list of questions that was carefully curated.
You're wild.
I always like to say in this podcast that it would be, if it's just us firing out questions, then, you know, we could just send you a questionnaire and you could write us some audio notes. But, you know, I already have made me think about that great walks that I've had up the canal going up towards the Antonine Wall. And I suppose, yeah, I can ask Luke this as well, but to start with end, I was like, Where would you then recommend a greenway that exists, or a greenway that maybe you've worked on the planning for that involves going past? You know, is there any basically example of, you know, a walk that one can do at the moment in Ireland that, you know, that kind of doesn't just treat the cultural heritage, historic environment as just something you have to get past? It's incorporated into it. Are there any examples of that, Enda, that you can think of? It could just be from your personal, where it's a good place to walk to see some castles or a Viking town or whatever it is.
there's quite a few. I'll try and limit it to three. So there's one of the kind of early ones that was very well publicized. That's the one from Dungarvan to Waterford. I think it's called the Copper Coast Greenway, or probably just the Waterford Greenway. utilizes a number of the railway tunnels and bridges, and it passes through the town of Kilmacthomas. Kilmacthomas is probably, it would be famous in an Irish context. It's where Flavins comes from. There's a nice collection of kind of 19th and early 20th century industrial kind of, I wouldn't say industrial, but rather rural industrial. So kind of where the rural landscape meets the urban landscape, and where grains were processed to create Flavins porridge. So you have a nice kind of engagement there with the landscape, the former railway line, the railway tunnel, the bridges, the kind of rural forward slash urban environment where grains were being processed. There's a lot to interpret there. It's a great little journey. One that might contrast with that a little bit is probably from, I think it's Newport heading west along the northern shore of Clew Bay. It's the Westport Greenway. Although it might be extended now, I think it goes from Westport now rather than Newport. That is fascinating and very engaging from a different perspective. It's quite a mountainous landscape. It's very much a rural landscape. You're not going to pass through any kind of once you leave Westport, you're not going to pass through any kind of urban environment whatsoever. It's something maybe you could relate to, Tom. It's very much a rural mountainous landscape that is both naturally beautiful but also unnaturally beautiful, because you would recognize this from the Highlands, that the landscape has been stripped of its tree cover, and it's very much a product of kind of farming and exploitative farming through, we'd say, the 17th through to the modern.
Is that sheep as well? As we've got deer as well. Yeah,
exactly. Deer and sheep. Yeah, and they're very interesting landscapes because for some people, they look at them and think they're fantastic, they're beautiful, but they're unnatural because they've been pared down to the bone. You know, so they've kind of there's a bit of a dichotomy there, really. And it's kind of had a negative impact on biodiversity, but quite different to that in Waterford. And then the third one, I think, which is a forthcoming one, I suppose, really, the one that we've been working on recently in South Kerry, along the Iveragh Peninsula. And there's some amazing infrastructure that was created to facilitate that railway. And this one is utilizing a railway, former railway line as well. That I'm really looking forward to when it opens in the near future, and traveling along that one. Beautiful coastline, stunning, absolutely stunning, and stunning 19th century industrial archaeology along the route. It'll be great. And well done to Kerry County Council and TII for having the vision and the concept. And off they go. And it's great to see it happening. And there's countless other ones, you know.
Yeah. Before we kind of bring this to a close and wrap it up, I just want to ask you about urban exploring. Mm. You have I don't know, is it still active, a blog about urban exploration and stuff?
Mm.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Talk to me about it. Do the ideologies kind of link in?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's observing the both the rural and urban landscape. I've mostly focused on disused schoolhouses and they're a reflection of the same motifs or concepts, the idea that the rural landscape has been somewhat neglected over the past 50 years, maybe even a century or whatever. And this is reflected in the kind of dereliction that we've come accustomed to in many kind of small towns across the country. It's just observation. You know, I don't do a lot of interpretation for that particular blog. It's mostly photographs and kind of minor interpretations. But the concepts are the same. You know, the concepts are the motifs are the same. They're ideas of it's kind of the word you used earlier, hollowing out. It's a bit of a brutal term, I suppose, and it does imply kind of an active kind of effort to hollow things out, which might not be true, but the consequences are the same, regardless of whether it was active or not. You know, the rural landscape is quite neglected. It has its own kind of derelict beauty, I suppose, in some ways. But, you know, that derelict beauty is quite voyeuristic. You know, it's just me kind of looking at it and going, oh, look at this dereliction, kind of, you know, being overrun with nature or whatever. It's quite different for people who still live in the landscape and you know, don't perhaps view it as beautiful, kind of view it as, you know, possibly an eyesore or kind of, you know, a monument to neglect, I suppose, really. It's the same way that people perhaps through the 60s and 70s might have what is viewed now today as kind of a scourge of the Irish landscape, the bungalow. I guess, like, you have to look at that from the perspective of people who were living in quite old houses from the 19th and 20th century. At the time when the bungalow came along, you know, it was like a palace. You know, people kind of got to move out of their old kind of vernacular houses and into what was basically a palace, and, you know, they're very, very grateful for it. And it's, we have a different perspective on it when we look at the rural landscape now and look at all these rural bungalows and go, God, there's such a blight on the landscape. If you were living in a damp 19th century or even older house in the 1950s or 60s, you'd have quite a different perspective. So the concepts of dereliction are very much, you have to contextualize them, and they're very much dependent on the observer. You know, people have different perspectives. You know.
Well, that was the same. Yeah, Glasgow. It's like, you know, for knocking down up half the city and the lovely tenements, but yeah, people had outdoor toilets and they were in single ends. So they had, like, you know, yeah, 5-10 people in essentially a studio flat. So I think that's an important point, is that we can't always judge by our present day, or we should never really judge by our current perspective as to how people looked at events in the past. And to wrap up myself, I think, again, what's made me think, you know, I've been thinking of just lastly in this podcast is, you know, when you see those sky, you know, the urban pollution or the sort of light pollution satellite images. And one thing always struck me about Ireland, and I think why greenways, I think now you've been talking about them, make such a great sense, is Ireland always looked quite dispersed. It wasn't like, if you compare it to Scotland, it's the central belt, it's just this flash of light and it's a little bit up the east coast. But Ireland had all these pockets of light. They had the big cities as well, and essentially around the coast mainly. But you had these pockets that did feel like there were still a lot of people living kind of in you know, sort of smaller sort of, you know, rural sort of towns. So, you know, when you're talking about greenways, it made me think, yeah, Ireland is kind of a place that's absolutely sort of ripe for that, you know, the cycle network and the greenways and everything you've been talking about. So yeah, it's been an eye opener for me as well. And this is the same for Luke. But yeah, so thank you so much, because we've been taking you away from actually working on these projects. So we're actually stopping them happening the longer that we talk to you. So I'll just say my thanks on behalf of the Luke and I, the Shindig podcast and the Red River Archaeology Group. And Luke always kind of leads us out at the end. But thank you very much, Enda.
No problem. Anytime.
Well, I have two questions to ask you. Silly ones to end the podcast. So this is effectively an archaeology podcast, history podcast. So my first question is, if you could place yourself back time travel style in any moment in history to get to witness it, where would you go?
Oh God, it's
I'll just say for the audio, the audio people, that the look on Enda's face there when he heard that.
You don't get to alter it. You can't alter it in any way.
Yeah.
Are you building a railway viaduct in the 19th century? what are we doing?
Oh, I'd have to think about that. That's at the moment, I'm quite taken by the development of the Irish rural landscape through, would say, the 18th and 19th century, would say late 18th and 19th century, particularly where I'm from in Clare Galway, just some work that I've been doing recently. So, I mean, I there wouldn't be one single event to go and look at, but I would love to maybe have some sort of montage of the development of the landscape through that time and see how it was enclosed, because I have a few suspicions about areas that weren't developed or enclosed in until probably the early part of the 19th century. So I'd love to know if that's true or not.
You want answers, basically. You don't want to...
Yeah. I'm curious, yeah. I love the first edition, Sixth St. Jordan and Survey map. I spent a lot of my time looking at it and time traveling in my head, imagining what the landscape looked like. I can see what it is like on paper, and I try to conceive what it might be like, have been like in real life, you know. Maybe the opportunity to observe the landscape around the time of the first edition Ordnance Survey, or just a little bit earlier, to see what it was like. It always looks so neat on paper, you know.
But I always think it's interesting to ask archaeologists this question, because as you said, they're time traveling in your own head. I'd imagine archaeologists spend a lot of their time doing that, basically trying to place themselves into a situation when they're looking at something, to what would this have looked like, or what would have been happening
to us? We strictly rely on the evidence, you know. We don't let personal feelings get into it at all.
Okay, so my second question is, you're awarded for your work in archaeology. They say, Enda, fantastic what you've done. It's amazing. Hypothetically.
I think it was Colm. I think Colm has said it. So.
Hypothetically. And the world has decided to reward you with anything from any museum in the world. You get to own it in your house. What artifact do you choose and why?
Not in a colonial way. Yeah. You can borrow it.
I couldn't possibly do that. I don't know. I can keep in my own house.
For me, it's like with my Viking stuff, it's just like various forms of silver. Essentially, it's very much the shiny things that I would just have more of them. I would just have a hoard of like 10,000 dirhams. I think, you know,
original Shakespeare manuscript would be mine.
I'll take the Touro stone, please, if that's okay.
No, so we'll have that organized for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why would you like that?
It's quite unique. It kind of it has this unusual place in kind of Irish prehistory. It has lots of Latin decoration in it. It is decorated. It's Latin decoration, but it's kind of a little bit of an anomaly. It was located kind of just outside Loch Ray in County Galway. It's been taken up from there and have shipped off to Denmark or possibly Holland for cleaning for the last couple of years, because it was I think maybe lichens that were forming on it that were probably harmful to the carvings. But it just sticks out as an oddity in Irish prehistory, and you know, it's quite unique. And if I'm going to have one thing, I might as well have something unique.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
and a great answers, good insight into you, and they loosely connect with what we spoke about today anyway. So it's quite good. Sure. I love it.
We have to stop now. This cannot get any better. Thank you again. Thank you. That's been absolutely fantastic. And so best luck with your work on the subject in the future. And hopefully we'll get you back on when you've done some more. But thank you again on behalf of everyone at the Red River Archaeology Group and the Shindig Archaeology Podcast.
Thank you.
I don't think we ever oversell at the beginning, because, you know, we only interview people that are amazing, and Enda proved that. Do you not think, Luke?
No, I think so. I think it was a really good one. I knew Enda would be a good one. He's part of the foundation of this company anyway, so it's great to have him on. But it's even better when you don't have to lie about your colleagues and say that they're brilliant, because the proof is there that they are.
Yeah, cool. And
it was great because I think it was one of these podcasts, you know, I've talked about this in the past, when you start thinking about parallels, I'm based mm-hmm. in Scotland, you start thinking about things a little, where active travel ways have happened in say Scotland, and you know, where I used to live in Durham, you know, the sort of famous, you know, as they're called or known as the Beeching Railway Cuts, and a lot of them are now active travel ways, and they've got plaques so you can tell, you can know that it was an old route to the mines and things like that, but now you can cycle and walk along it as well. So it made me think, hopefully it made you guys think, and it certainly made me find the Hardy Bucks, and now a huge fan. So,
for our Irish listeners and viewers, the Hardy Bucks you probably are aware of. For anyone outside, look them up. I'm fairly sure you'll find it on YouTube. It's an Irish comedy mockumentary, and it's a very good look at I suppose a parody of Irish life in the countryside, modern Irish life in the countryside. Not, we spoke on this podcast about a little bit of the kind of romanticized version of Ireland. This kind of parody is the real version of Ireland that is there now.
We were just even chatting before we started recording, and I was saying it was quite striking, and I know Enda referenced, you know, they always have a bit where they're on the abandoned railway bridge.
Yeah,
It is really, really central to it. And I think, you know, we were discussing just beforehand, there's a sort of visual metaphor for they're kind of trapped, these guys.
Yeah, they're trapped in small town Ireland, because the way to take them out has literally been taken away from them. So for them to be on this disused railway bridge, it's a great visual.
Yeah, exactly. And it's they don't make a big play of it, but you know, it's one of these things that is quite deep. And I think one of these things that we now understand better if you listening to that podcast. And it's just great that, you know, these places are being opened up again. Especially, you know, being heritage led is fantastic, and you know, developer led, and sense of through commercial archaeology and local councils that are really getting involved in this. So I think this is I think of many of our podcasts, this is one that will sort of that will be relevant years from now,
because exactly, people will still be doing this. It's probably more relevant years from now, because this work is only really getting started and really coming to the forefront of in Ireland in particular anyway at the moment. But if you enjoyed it, let us know. Leave us a comment on YouTube, leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook, search Red River Archaeology or Rubicon Heritage Services, anywhere at all that you get your social media. Make sure you hit like, make sure you hit follow, make sure you hit subscribe. And as I say, just keep letting us know what you want to hear or what you want to see on the Shindig. My name is Luke Barry.
And I'm Tom Horn, and thank you for listening.
Beautiful.
Love it.